This is the Third Degree, Environment and Social Justice, Conversations and Current Affairs on 2SER. I'm Jessica Minchell. On today's show, we're talking left politics and what it means to identify as left-leaning in the current social and political climate. Joining me in the studio is Anthony Lowenstein, independent journalist, author, blogger and commentator on a wide range of issues, including Israeli apartheid, treatment of refugees and the role of online media. His most recent book, Left Turn, Political Essays for the New Left, is co-edited with Jeff Sparrow, editor of the Overland Literary Journal. It was published by Melbourne University Press last month. It's an expansive collection of writings on many of the issues often lambasted as being the domain of progressives in this country, and provides alternative ways of thinking about these issues and left politics. And Anthony Lowenstein is here to talk us through it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Larissa Berendt, Christos Tsolkas, Nazim Hussain and Wendy Bacon are just few of the authors of essays in Left Turn. In the introduction, you and Jeff Sparrow explain having an intention to seek out writers who self-identify as left-leaning. How crucial was this for you when you first started thinking about this project?
Jeff and I started talking about this in 2010, so a while ago, and the brief history, I'll make it very quick, is that Obama had won the election in the US in 2008, and many on the left in the US had embraced him because they were sick of 8 years of Bush, they were sick of the Republican Party, and Obama sort of framed himself as, you know, change we can believe in, you know, yes we can, that kind of whole mindset. Fast forward to 2010, and there was profound disillusionment on a range of issues, whether it was to do with domestic politics, national security, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And Jeff and I were talking about why so many of those left voices in the US often weren't being heard. Fast forward to the Australian election 2010, Gillard won, just as we know, and we're in this minority government as it is, and we thought maybe we would do some essays together and develop those thoughts. And it came out of the belief that on so many key issues in the last decade, Iraq, Afghanistan, terrorism, climate change, the environment, unions, the economy, the GFC, pretty much every major issue that I'm sure I've missed out some, gay marriage, many other key issues that many people care about, on the left and the right for that matter, virtually every single mainstream pundit was wrong on everything. And yet they are rewarded for doing so. So Jeff and I were not arguing these people should be, you know, put in the square and hung or anything. We're simply saying that the mainstream press rewards failure. So the idea that we can have a mature discussion in Australia, or for that matter in the US, where these debates are, although there are more, is more media there because there's more people, the debates and the people who populate the mainstream press is pretty similar. People who are close to power. And as we argue in the book and a lot of the essays articulate, it's very much to say that society is increasingly about insiders and outsiders, and the ABC show The Insiders almost epitomises what we think is wrong with so much of the mainstream press. We have journalists who essentially, you know, don't really go anywhere. They mostly stay in Canberra. Some of them, of course, come from other states, to be sure. But their mindset is that they are rewarded by going on that show and others, by being close to media advisors, by being close to politicians, by being close to business leaders. That's what supposedly makes them successful or worthwhile, and their editors like them for being like that. Well, our view is, and a lot of the commentators and writers and journalists in the book refuse that idea, that being an insider and often fundamentally is against what is going to be important to get a sense of what's happening out there. So the essays from those different writers, and there are about 14 of them, I think, come from a range of perspectives. Some people who are very well known, the ones you've mentioned. Some writers many readers won't have heard of. They generally have all been published, Melbourne, Sydney and elsewhere, other parts of the country. So that was the general underpinning of the book.
And so how did you go about thinking of who would be good to write on these issues, and also selecting what topics would be a part of this book?
Yeah, there's no doubt that since the book's come out, some people are saying, why didn't you talk about this or why didn't you talk about that? And I guess whatever those issues that they're referring to, this was not supposed to be a manifesto per se. So it wasn't supposed to be, as some people have asked, like a political document to start a political party or something like that, nothing at all. It was people who generally we knew or we knew of or we liked their work or they represented something that we thought was worth listening to. It wasn't supposed to be exhaustive. In terms of the issues, again, a conversation Jeff and I had over a number of months starting in 2010 about what issues we thought were relevant around the time of a 2010 election. Now, clearly, Afghanistan, for argument's sake, wasn't that much discussed in the election or, for that matter, much at all anywhere these days, or Iraq even less so. But it was the thought, I suppose, of having people, as we say in the introduction, who'd be provocative, who would challenge, who would hopefully make people uncomfortable, who would in some ways upset people, who would not be afraid, pardon me, of being provocative. And we feel that on so many key issues, the ones I mentioned before and others, you are rewarded in the press and the voices that are heard are those who don't do that. There's a very narrow scope of people who generally have access to the mainstream corporate press, and their views are very prescribed, they're very safe. So if you say something so-called controversial, it's generally speaking, often in the tabloid press, attacking an asylum seeker is not exactly brave. When you know, the front page of a Daily Telegraph, you know, I mean, that doesn't exactly take much bravery to do that. Or you're a talk show host and you're slagging off single mothers or whatever it may be. So that is, in inverted commas, controversial but fairly predictable. So, yeah, there was a decision to tackle a number of issues, and there are many others we could have included and other voices we could have included. And for those people who might say, well, why didn't you write about X or Y, I would say Left Turn 2 is for yours to do.
And why do you think this self-identifying as left-leaning is so important, or what do you think it says about this broader culture of a nervousness of identifying as a certain politics, particularly within media or as commentators?
Most journalists, certainly, and commentators as well, actually really seem petrified of calling themselves left. There's nothing wrong with saying you're right, or that you support the Liberal Party, or you think Tony Abbott would be a good Prime Minister. And that's a legitimate view. I don't personally share it, but you know, people have the right to say that. If they want to vote for him, good luck with that next year. But what I think happened in Australia is that in the last years, and this I think has been very much imported from the US in terms of the whole culture wars that the Republican Party and Fox News have perfected in some ways so brilliantly in the last decade, decade and a half, that individuals who are progressive, liberal, call it whatever you want, left, often have less access to media, and think tanks on the right have been very effective in the last 20 years in the US. That's now being imported to Australia as well, to put arguments across, get access to the press, etc. Now, again, all legitimate, mostly legal, that's fine. But I think many writers are petrified, and journalists that I know of, some of whom are in the book, many of whom are not, of being identified as the left. And Jeff and I, when we were talking about the book, were saying we can't think of one commentator in the mainstream who would proudly say they're left. Now, that doesn't mean that they should stand up and, you know, wear a badge and say, hello, my name is Jake, you know, I'm a left winger. We're not saying that at all. But you asked before, why does the left matter? Well, historically, on a range of things, the left has got a lot of stuff wrong and a lot of stuff right. And historically also, there's no doubt that a lot of key issues coming from a progressive left perspective matters politically. One has to look at what's happening in Greece today, for example, and the book touches on this in passing, that you have a strongly far-left political party which came very close to winning the presidency and the leadership of that country a few weeks ago. They lost, to be sure, but they got very close. And, of course, you also have a very, very far right, the Golden Dawn neo-Nazi party, who's in parliament. So these issues and political divisions do matter. And I think in Australia, it was also a chance to throw and sort of say that let's be proud of what left history can be, and also reclaim the word of being a leftist. And again, I should just finish by saying that in the introduction we explain, it's not about if you agree with us, therefore you're left. We're not trying to be authoritarian or ideological about this. We're saying that, and we try to define what the left is. It's fairly broad, anti-authoritarian, generally progressive, other definitions as well. And that to us matters. And I think it's a problem that a lot of people in Australia, particularly journalists, are petrified of being called left. They want to be seen as balanced or objective. It's okay if they're right wing, that's of course fine, but you can't be left. And my work over the years, and Jeff in a separate way as well, has proudly said, we are left, we're progressive, we can be journalists, commentators, writers, authors, and then have to sort of hide that in shame.
So just on that, what does it mean for you to identify as left in today's political climate?
I think my politicisation happened in the 90s. I'm from Melbourne. I was editing the student newspaper at Monash University called Lot's Wife, and which is still going. And I was somehow grew up in a fairly conservative, liberal, when I say liberal, liberal Jewish home to an extent, but fairly conservative politically. University happened, I became politicised on a range of issues, and it was partly through the VSU legislation, which eventually went through, which essentially was voluntary student unionism, which at the time in the 90s in Victoria was defeated, and then John Howard brought it in, and now it's been successful from their perspective, I should say. My political awakening also happened a lot over Israel-Palestine. Started writing about this issue in many ways 2003, so the last 9 years. And I think it's partly, I don't necessarily see it as a left position so much as a critical of the status quo, which is the blind support you often see on many parts of the right and the centre, and indeed even the blind left, of Israeli apartheid against Palestine under the guise of Israel's a democracy, etc., etc. So that's where it came from me. And I think as the years have gone on, I've never been a member of a political party. I'm not a member of a party now. I won't join one, mainly because this, I think, has been a shift in the last decades, that years ago, if you were left, you identified as the left, you probably would join a party, have a card, go to meetings, etc. It wouldn't be the Greens then, it could have been the Communist Party, it could have been a range of other parties, it could have even been Labour, believe it or not, you know, not that long ago. Those days, I think, have generally changed. And I also don't want to join a party because I feel as a journalist it's better to keep a degree of distance. I have certain views about Labour and the Greens that I've written about in the book Articulate. So, yeah, my political journey, I suppose, was unconventional in a way. But now, at my age, and not that I'm that old, I'm only 37, but I mean at my age compared to when I started being a journalist 9 years ago, professionally, I feel a lot more comfortable saying this kind of stuff openly. I don't mean that I was saying it secretly 6 years ago, but I think as a lot of young journalists who may have these similar kind of views will feel as they're starting out, they don't want to be too openly, almost openly political, unless it's going to be views that are seen as uncontroversial.
There's not much space for the left in public discourse at the moment, nor for the differences within the left to be explained. How do you see the broadness of the left, or the broadness within the left, and people are part of that, dealing with that narrowness of space?
Challenging. There's no doubt that this book, or me, or anyone you speak to who says that they have the solutions, they're clearly lying badly. We don't know. I think one of the things that we're trying to do with the book, and some of the work that I do and Jeff does separately as well, is to really start a conversation. I think we're still at a stage in Australia where, and this has even come up again recently in the mainstream press, we have this almost faux fight between the Labour Party or certain elements in the Labour Party and the Greens. Labour's calling the Greens, they're extreme, they're crazy, they're mad. Labour, of course, are rational and mature, so the argument goes. And but the truth is that, of course, masks a deep fear in the ALP, that a lot of people who, A, used to support the Labour Party, more than have actually gone to the Liberal Party than they have the Greens, which most of the media ignores. But yes, many younger people who join a political party these days will get engaged. There are some young, I know some young Labour people, yes, but they're mostly going to the Greens, if you're quite liberal and so-called liberal and left-wing and progressive. Refugees, climate change, whatever the issue might be that interests you. I think the spaces in Australia that need to be found are supporting financially and otherwise independent press. Community radio is part of that. Independent media, as the mainstream press slowly but increasingly collapses. Fairfax obviously is on the verge of some kind of profound shift. The Murdoch press has viability to the extent that Rupert supports it while he's still alive. Now, when he goes, which will happen at some point, then the way the newspapers will be seen could be different. So I very much say, and the book talks about this, Wendy Bacon has a chapter in the book talking specifically about what progressive media means. And again, there's no soundbite answer to that, but I generally agree with most of what she's saying, that there is a need, I think, to both try to still find spaces in the mainstream press to be heard, but at the same time, I think also it's vital to support, and that's going to mean, frankly, financially, independent media. The truth is that good journalism costs money, and although I'm very much a believer, personally, and I'm just speaking for myself here, in public broadcasting, the ABC, SBS, I'm not for a second saying we should pay for those, but I do think that for other independent media sometimes, and you see this overseas, and a lot of websites that are trying to do interesting independent journalism, it costs some money. And not because I want to personally get paid a fortune to go to Afghanistan where I just was, but yes, I want to get some kind of financial support and assistance for that. And I think as the mainstream media formats collapse, the business models collapse, there will be, I'm hoping, and you see some elements of this overseas and some elements here too, of a sense that if people actually want to get really interesting, important, provocative, challenging material, they may have to pay for it. And that's more than paying, for argument's sake, you know, $1.70 for the Herald every day.
You're listening to The Third Degree on 2SER. I'm Jessica Mintle, and my guest today is independent journalist Anthony Lowenstein. We're discussing left politics and the newly published Left Turn collection of political essays edited by Lowenstein. And we've been talking about media, and in your essay, Media War Junkies Unite, you're quite critical of Australian press not holding governments to account over war crimes. Why do you think this is something that didn't happen, or as something that many would see as being radical if it did?
You mean, for example, the argument that a mainstream newspaper says that Tony Blair should be taken to the ICC, for example? You know, it's seen as crazy, the idea that you would say in the mainstream press a leader of Britain, Australia, America should be held to account for alleged crimes against humanity, for sanctioning torture. It's seen as controversial when, in fact, it should be anything but. We have no issue supporting the extradition of terrible African leaders, for argument's sake, to The Hague to be tried, and I support that. Charles Taylor, the former head of Liberia, recently was found guilty, the first former head of state who was found guilty of crimes against humanity. He'll spend, by the sounds of most of the rest of his, all the rest of his life in jail. So what I talk about in that chapter, and I've written about this for a number of years, this was born out of the frustration I saw during the start of the Iraq War, which was 2003, was that the views of non-establishment figures that got everything so right, that war was such an unmitigated disaster. There were probably a million casualties at least, putting aside the casualties on the US, Australian and other forces side. Iraq is virtually out of the news now, although it's slipping back into a quasi kind of civil war situation. Violence is very extreme. That what you find, I think, is a belief of many in the corporate press to give elite immunity. So whereas there could be a story that says, oh, there was torture sanctioned in Iraq and Australian troops could have been involved in that potentially 2003, 2004, 2005, there's never the logical next step, which is, well, where's that coming from? It just wasn't simply just a couple of, usually at least, rogue dudes interested in tying some guy up in the middle of a desert. But in America, for example, it's very clear. There's much evidence to show that Donald Rumsfeld, who was a defense secretary from 2001 onwards, directly sanctioned torture, directly ordered officials in various parts around the world, Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, to torture captured terror suspects. There is no serious move in the US, or for that matter in many other parts of the world, except in a few countries in Europe, which have a desire sometimes to hold people accountable outside of their own jurisdiction, to put people like that on trial. Now, this is seen and framed as this crazy idea that you would hold people to account. The chapter, in some ways, I don't mention this, but it was inspired by a lot of the writings by Glenn Greenwald. Some people may have heard of him. He's a Salon.com writer, former constitutional lawyer, American guy, now living in Brazil. One of the best writers, in my view, around at the moment. He's written about all this kind of stuff. He's a journalist, commentator. And he's written his last book, in fact, was all about the fact that the American media and political elites protect themselves. And this happens, of course, with the Wall Street financial crash as well. Obama has not prosecuted one person in the last 4 years, despite the fact that the money that was lost was massive. So what I'm trying to say in the chapter is that there needs to be a degree of accountability. And the reason I think there's not is that many, I think, in the press, journalists, commentators, and editors, I think, much prefer to see themselves as being part of a cozy elite. I'm not saying that they therefore support torture. Some do. Many do not. But we're still conditioned to believe that that sort of punishment happens to people over there, Africa, you know, crazy parts of Africa, as opposed to here, or the US, or Britain. And until that happens, until there's a sense that international law actually is universal, as opposed to very selective, we can't be surprised that in most parts of the world, international justice is seen as a joke because it only punishes those who the West doesn't like anymore, as opposed to our own leaders and generals, etc.
But how much of that is also about mainstream media being incredibly political in its attempt at not being political in a way?
I think there is some truth in that, but of course, as I argue in the book, and I've argued in many other places as well, the fact that you don't call for that sort of thing is inherently problematic, profoundly problematic. If you don't hold people to account for alleged crimes, torture, etc., they're bound to happen again. And I think many in the corporate press, even, and I give lots of examples, you know, give clear evidence that there has been serious torture or indoctrinatory rendition or crimes against humanity in a range of countries, Iraq, Afghanistan, much of the Middle East, there is still this reluctance to go the next step forward. And I think there is, my sense is that there are two reasons. One, I think afraid to be seen as, that's seen as just beyond the pale. Then international justice is still very young in its development. That's very true. And it, generally speaking, it only is affecting those individuals and groups who are not in the West. And I give the examples in the chapters. It drives me mental. Tony Blair, who was obviously former British Prime Minister, is routinely still interviewed in the media in a friendly sense about, so, you know, what's your views, Tony, about the Middle East? As if, hang on a second, are we just forgetting everything that's happened in the last 10 years? Support for the war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, war, Israel war against Lebanon, torture. I mean, there is so much evidence against him that the concept that the media still treats him with respect. And again, I'm not saying someone like him should be, you know, put in the square and hung. I'm saying that someone like him, if we live in a just world and there was a sense that accountability mattered for everybody, and our media does not want that, clearly, someone like him would not be treated to a friendly sit-down chat in front of a fireplace discussing his views about Christianity and love and religion, which happens often.
So back to this idea about having a really narrow space for broad differences within the left, was that a conscious decision to focus on the issues with this book and for the politics to come out through them? Or is it about creating new spaces for those complexities to be worked out and be at the forefront of these issues as well?
I think it was both. I can't speak for Jeff, but I think we both pretty much had a similar vision about it, that the sense was, a lot of the chapters, the views, for example, are quite provocative. For example, we talk about, there's one chapter by Chris Graham, who discusses the intervention on the one hand, but and is opposed to it, which of course we shouldn't forget, just last week in the Australian Parliament, both Labor and Liberal both agreed to extend the intervention for many, many more years and in fact deepen it. There is profound bipartisan support for that intervention, even though many Indigenous groups who are affected by it are opposed to it. There's virtually no debate about that. The mainstream press barely allows Indigenous voices, let alone anybody else, to say, hang on a second, is there any evidence it's actually working? And the evidence, in fact, is that it's not working at all. But putting that issue aside for a second, Chris argues that in many cases, and he gives discussions about certain very impoverished Indigenous townships, violence can be justified. Now, he's not arguing, as some people have said, he's calling, you know, for, you know, suicide bombers in the Opera House, nothing like that. We're talking about, and he's talking about, the idea that, and this is a case, and almost it's a logical thing to say, that, and you see this in many other conflicts around the world, that sometimes the only way for impoverished and besieged people to be heard is to resist what is happening to them, and that sometimes is going to be violent.
Yeah, in a way, Chris Graham isn't even making that strong an argument for violence, but he's rather saying that he understands why violence exists.
Yes, and even having that discussion about saying that in some town where police violence is seen as normal, it's seen as defensive, it's seen as acceptable, it's seen as what choice do these poor white policemen have? The idea, as you rightly say, that Chris argues that there should be an ability to resist that, and that potentially is going to be violent. And again, I think even having those conversations is seemingly impossible because then you're suddenly accused of, you know, supporting violence against the police or something. There's no real space to have these kind of conversations. And we're not arguing in the book this is, you know, it's a crazy case of, you know, North Korean censorship here. We're not saying about that. I think a lot of it is self-censorship. There's an idea that only has to look at the opinion pages of most of the mainstream media, lots of the discussion that goes on the radio, including ABC, with some exceptions, of course, particularly with Radio National. It's very safe and very prescribed and quite dull. But that's exactly the point. That's exactly what they want. They basically want to make people sort of happy and comfortable, not particularly upset. Now, I'm not saying the job should make people pissed off every second of the day, but I'm saying that on a lot of these issues we talk about in the book, there's a reason to get aggravated, to get, you know, to have a discussion, and I think those spaces need to be reclaimed.
And how are you hoping that Left Turn will help shape this discourse as an ongoing conversation?
Yes, I mean, we saw the book and it's doing, I'm pleased to say the book is doing well, it's selling well and there's an interest in it. I think The idea behind it was to stimulate discussion to provoke people to hopefully continue the conversation themselves, whether it's politically or socially or whatever it may be. It seems to be having that effect. Now, if you ask me, you know, is every idea in the book going to be taken up and implemented? No, I'd say probably not. I mean, to me, the discussion in Australia is so infantile about politics that to even get to the stage where we're saying, can we have a serious discussion about the intervention or media or gay marriage or the war? Even saying that and having that space is seemingly difficult to find. So if nothing else, the book has generated some of that, and we hope, of course, it continues.
You're currently working on a number of different projects, including a documentary and book on disaster capitalism and privatisation.
Mm.
So what is disaster capitalism, and how are you looking at it?
In brief, disaster capitalism really is the concept of, after a disaster or a situation, it may be a war, it could be a cyclone, it could be a hurricane, it could be something like that, private corporations go into an area, a country, and make a killing from that to exploit suffering, essentially. It could be, though, something else. It could be, for argument's sake, Australia has all the detention centres of refugees is run by Serco, a British multinational, under the guise of being more efficient. So what I'm looking at is using disaster capitalism and vulture capitalism as the broad issue, and using a number of case studies. So briefly, been to Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, looking at the role of private security and private intelligence post 9/11, the role of Serco in detention centres in Australia, the role of private security companies and foreign companies making a killing from mineral resources in Papua New Guinea. And shortly I'm going to Haiti to look at the role there of, there was an earthquake there 2.5 years ago, and the country was in pretty bad shape before the earthquake. And the way that development, so to speak, has happened there has principally come through Western corporations and governments supporting exploitative policies. So these are the various examples that I'm using to prove a broader point. I think it's sadly increasingly how our world is now designed, with virtually complete bipartisan support, very little media discussion, that the world's being privatised and outsourced with not much discussion at all. So that needs to happen.
You've been listening to The Third Degree in conversation today with independent journalist Anthony Lowenstein. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
And Left Turn is published by Melbourne University Press and available at most bookstores.
And is an e-book as well.
Great. I'm Jessica Mitchell, and this is 2SER.